Welcome to the Protocols webinar series presented by the Society of American Archivists Native American Archives section. Webinar number one, titled Building Relationships of Mutual Respect, hosted by Jennifer O'Neill with guest Jonathan Pringle. The Protocols webinar series will cover one or more of the 10 core sections of the Protocols for Native American Archival Materials, which is a document that establishes best practices for the culturally responsive care and use of Native American archival materials, particularly materials that are housed in non-tribal institutions. A link below on this slide takes you to the entire document. Also listed here are the 10 core sections of the protocols that we'll be covering as we make our way through the webinars during the coming months. Each of the webinars will highlight one of these core sections.
Well, welcome, Jonathan. We're so excited to have you with us on our very first Protocols webinar, where the goal we're so excited. Thank you so much for being with us. The goal of why we wanted to do these webinars is to provide archivists in the field and others who want to know more about the protocols really tangible, practical examples of how the implementation of the protocols works in repositories, most notably non-tribal repositories, and for how we're building out these webinars as we're picking different themes of the protocols to touch on and expand upon to give people a chance to see how this really works. And we thought one way to do that is to expand and talk about some of the case studies that have already been submitted for the Native American Archives section focusing on the protocols. And you were one of the first to submit a case study. So we thought it'd be a wonderful opportunity to speak with you about that and to hear a bit more about the work that you've done over the years working with tribal communities. So to start us off, we'd love to hear a little bit more about your career, especially at Northern Arizona University, where I know that the case study that you're focused on talks about your time there. We know you just transitioned to a brand new position at the University of New Mexico. So share with us a little bit about your time at NAU, what you did there, and then maybe tell us also about your new position, because we'd love to hear about that.
Sure. Well, hello, everybody. It's nice to meet you all virtually. And if I don't answer questions or I'm not clear here, I'm always happy to answer anything via email or phone, mostly email. But I am on call here and happy to elaborate on anything that I am answering here for you. So anyway, as Jennifer, as you pointed out, my name is Jonathan Pringle, and I have been an archivist professionally for the past 11 years. And my trajectory is I'm originally Canadian. And at the time that I was applying for graduate school, I was living in Northern Canada. And I felt like it was important for me to take a master's degree or do some education in some area that I could integrate concepts and ideas of indigenous awareness and cultural humility and competency. So I thought that it would be a smart idea for me if I was going to apply for graduate school to be an archivist, that I should also take a First Nations concentration. And so the University of British Columbia offers that as a add-on to its Master of Archival Studies as well as its Library Science program. And it was a very helpful way for me to help bridge what we're learning in class with traditional and historic archival theory and methodology with community-based needs. And so I was really interested and excited by that. I had intended to return to Northern Canada after I was done. I was living up in Yellowknife and thought that's where I was going to go back. But life had a different plan for me, and so I ended up in the desert in Arizona and ended up working for the Museum of Northern Arizona for 3 years as their archivist. And I got to implement some of the ideas behind the protocols at that position there. But then after 3 years there, I was offered a position at Northern Arizona University's Klein Library, which is the library that brought together the folks that drafted the protocols for Native American archival materials, as Jennifer very well knows. So I felt like there was a great kind of a baseline understanding and support system built into that institution that we could really try and do a couple of different things. So that's kind of my nutshell where I was while I was at Northern Arizona University. I recently left, and now I am the scholarly communication and digital librarian for the Health Sciences Library and Informatics Center at the beautiful campus of University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. I've been here for just over 2 months, and lots to learn, and I'm excited. Maybe some of my questions will actually pertain to some ideas I have preliminarily about how to take what I've done at NEU and see what we can do here at UNM. So I'm excited about that. So lots of growth and lots of opportunity, but happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your background and your career, because I know that's really shaped the work that you've done with tribal communities and your career in general. So it's so wonderful to see and to talk about your time at NAU, but then to see you transition into this new position. In the case study, I know you mentioned how NAU really served as a host of the protocols group that was developed in 2006. So to build upon that a little bit, and I know you talk about that in the case study, can you explain a little bit of NAU's role with the development of the protocols, and mainly touching on a little bit of a lot of that foundational work, because the goal or main theme of this first webinar is really highlighting what it takes to build these strong relationships with tribal communities, particularly based in respect and reconciliation, and often leading to some amazing projects. So the goal of that is really talking about how do you build these relationships, how does that actually occur, and what does that look like, and also the length of time that that takes to build that. And I know NAU has been extremely proactive in a lot of the work that they've done, but especially with them hosting the protocols, can you talk a little bit more about that and really how that work helped to build a lot of this work that is continued there?
Sure, and I really can't answer that question without acknowledging the work and the hard work and dedication of Karen Underhill, who was my first supervisor at Northern Arizona University's Klein Library. Really, she was at the forefront of bringing together a lot of people to really develop these protocols. And I know she's got a lot of humility and doesn't give herself enough credit for that. But I mean, I think going back to the late 90s when we hosted the Navajo Treaty at Klein Library, that was really inspiring to see what we could do as a form of reconciliation and bringing the document back to the people. I thought that was a really great thing that we did. I wasn't here for that, but Karen was really proud of that piece of the history. And then segueing into the year 2000, when we developed Klein Library, Special Collections and Archives developed an MOA with the Hopi tribe with the management of their materials. And that's evolved over the last little while. And then building on that, Karen in 2004 or five, wanted to apply for a sabbatical so that she could do something really meaningful and bring together these international experts, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to develop and draft these protocols. And so she was successful in getting her sabbatical, and she wrote a grant to support the travel costs to bring folks to Flagstaff for a few days. And then afterwards, it was a lot of back and forth with the authors of that document to finalize the final version of the protocols and have it ready for publication by 2006.
Thank you so much for sharing a little bit of that history, because I know it's really important to how you all have been able to build that foundation but I know you were also pointing out that a lot of that work had also even started before the protocols were drafted, mm-hmm. and those are relationships that have been built over numerous years with different tribal communities that surround NAU. So I also just want to highlight that even though the protocols were developed in 2006, that NAU was far ahead of many institutions or had already been developing a lot of that far before the protocols were even developed.
To comment on that as well, I'd just like to say that the university itself has as one of its strategic goals, right towards the top, its commitment to serving Native Americans. And that's been in one of the strategic priorities for a number of years now. And that alone gives the institution and the subsequent units within a lot of leverage to explore some ideas that really support that goal. So I think at NEU is a really remarkable place. And one of the things that I would say and talk about that, if it's not a question that comes up a little bit later, is just how important it is at that high administrative level that there's already that built-in support. So all that advocacy work that goes into making that an important commitment for the university really makes all the other activities and tasks that we become engaged with that much easier to support.
No, I think that's great that you point that out, because I think having that institutional support and that institutional framework that they are recognizing and acknowledging the importance of working with tribal communities as well as tribal sovereignty, which I know that you point out throughout your case study, and which we also established as one of the key foundational elements of the protocols, is recognizing, adhering to, and respecting tribal sovereignty, but that the university itself is actually putting that in their strategic goals is huge, mm-hmm. because not every university does that. And so being part of and having that a piece, that foundational piece, is really great. And so that really sets, I think, the university apart as well.
Right.
Yeah, so I know one of the great things that you talked about in your case study, which I wanted to talk with you about, is that you highlighted how NAU was both proactive in its outreach to tribal communities, as well as doing it on an ad hoc basis. So mm-hmm. can you tell us or give us a few examples of how that proactive work was done, and then also more of how you did how the repository did ad hoc work and kind of the differences between that and how that led to some of the projects that you worked on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say in terms of being proactive, it really comes down to starting off with good policies and procedures. I think that because of the ability to build off of the university's strategic goal that really helped us with the initiatives that we wanted to take on, that we felt the support already, that we could say, let's develop some collections management or collection development policies that integrate concepts within the protocols so that we can actually use this as a tool for working with our donors, for example, on acquisition of materials that maybe we shouldn't acquire in the first place. Just by way of example, we'd be offered some images of a Hopi snake dance from a creator from many, many decades ago. And the donor is really excited to give those to us, but we could back that up with policy to say that we don't feel like that's the best approach for us to take this in, and we think that your better institution might be the Hopi Cultural Preservation Office. That's just by way of example with that there. Proactive with just even in the hiring process, making sure that in our searches that we're looking for folks and individuals that share that kind of a value and a commitment to issues of inequity and social justice, and looking for a good fit to make sure that those ideas are carried forward with this next generation. So even though I left, there was another individual who replaced me who similarly has a First Nations concentration from the University of British Columbia with an archival studies degree. And it was a nice transition to see that work will carry forward. She's already done a lot of work in her previous career. So this is Sam Meyer. She joined the team a few months ago at Klein Library. So I know that there's that initiative there. So I would be surprised if that momentum didn't carry forward in future searches. So those are just two examples of kind of like being proactive. I already mentioned the Hopi Cultural Preservation Office and the MOA with them. I know that previously when people asked me for a draft of that or something, if I could share that with them, I was able to. So I'm sure that my former supervisor would be totally fine with sharing that with whomever's interested. But that really codified a lot of really interesting relationships, collaborative understandings between the Hopi tribe and us at Klein Library. And I think really at the heart of that document is an understanding and an acknowledgement of this historic power imbalance. You know, we're these big institutions that house these materials that the Hopi people are valid stakeholders in their history and how they're being portrayed in these records that we have. They may not have created them, but they are still an important stakeholder in their representation. And so these the MOA that we had or have had, I'm going to go back in present and past tense here every once in a while. It really codifies a lot of that building, breaking down of those power struggles or dynamics and saying, here's what we can do for you to help you with the management of your collections. We can offer this kind of storage environment for your own Hopi-born materials. And in turn, maybe you can help us with some understanding or cultural awareness of sensitive materials in holdings that we have here. And you can help us understand where to place appropriate restrictions on those materials. So it was a wonderful kind of, and it is still, a great back and forth relationship. And we use the Hopi as a great kind of a case because we had been working with them for so long that it just made sense that we were gonna really promote that as one of our strengths with one of our collaborative partnerships. So maybe I just gave you three examples of kind of proactive, but then there's always ad hoc. And so maybe that also comes down to policy though, but being prepared for having to react to something and you need somebody to step in to help you with identifying something that's sensitive or placing appropriate restrictions, whether at the use level or the access level. And just knowing who to reach out to in those kinds of situations. So Arizona is a kind of a tight-knit group and archival group. And so we know who to talk to help us understand certain things. So we were never struggling to try to find the appropriate person to help us understand the context of something that we had in our holdings. or we weren't afraid to ask those questions if they came up on an ad hoc basis.
Yeah, those are really great examples that you provide both for proactive and then ad hoc that things when things come up. I'm really glad you pointed out that reciprocal nature of some of those more proactive projects that you've worked on, because I think, of course, that's at the central point of the protocols is not only do the protocols provide guidance to what repositories' responsibilities are, but it also provides guidance on what we would we hope that the tribal communities might also help us with in helping to preserve their materials or helping to provide the right perspective on their materials as well. That there are things that we know that we don't have the expertise in, and so it's really great to get that expertise from the tribal community, as well as just being able to have that back and forth so it doesn't feel one-sided, but that it builds an actual relationship, not just like a you provide this for us because we have your materials, but it's an actual building of a relationship and a partnership that can lead to hopefully other projects as well too.
Yeah, and I would also say that a great benefit to these kinds of collaborative relationships is that you really get that community context that really helps our researchers, our students, our faculty to understand not only the historic context in which something was made or preserved, but also the community's perspective on that same record. And I think a great example of that is the Mukutu CMS and the work with the Plateau People's Web Portal, among many other successful projects that really utilize technology and digitization and this concept of digital repatriation as a way to really inform a much greater breadth of understanding between cultures.
Yeah, no, it's a great thing that can come out of all of this great work that we do to work with tribal communities, especially these digital platforms. I know one of the other proactive things that you point out in the case study that I just wanted to touch on quickly as well too, because I think it's a great example of something basic that people can do, is that I know that one thing you pointed out that NAU did is just the basics of when you're cataloging your materials or knowing what's in your collection that does represent tribal communities, so that you know what you have, and that when you are working with tribal communities or you're trying to come up with a project that you can work with people on, you know what materials that you have from their community, and you can also share that with them. Because one of the huge things that I always talk about when I give presentations about the protocols is there's been numerous calls to action by other activists even before we've developed the protocols. And one was just kind of the basic of knowing where these collections are and knowing what materials are in these repositories. So I think even just you all doing that and knowing the number of items or collections in your repository that related to tribal communities, that's huge. And I think that has also led to different partnerships and different work. And I know you talked about how that then led to some digital work. So I think just being able to know what people have and so that they can then inform these communities is so important. So I didn't know if you wanted to comment any more about that.
Well, that was a project that actually was quite time consuming. And in retrospect, I wonder if I would do it a little differently. But we developed a Indigenous People's Guide to Materials in Special Collections and Archives. And we broke it down by community. And I've been working on some of the other communities, but I started with a really small one, the Zuni Pueblo, so I could at least have a case study and a test bed to see what in totality between our analog and our digitized holdings do we have that pertain to the Zuni. And so that one is available there at this resource that's linked right from the NU Klein Library's homepage. But the one that I spent probably the most time on was the largest of the communities. It was the Diné or the Navajo. And that one took so much time because I had to comb through a lot of instances of the word Navajo, Diné, Navajo spelled with an H or a J, to try to find in our finding guides, predominantly describing analog holdings and our digital holdings, all of the world of information that Klein Library Special Collections and Archives has pertaining to the Navajo. And because there was so many collections and individual items, I thought that it would make more sense to break them down by meaningful subject or category, often based on what we know our research interests by folks that come and visit with us. So environment was a popular, health and water. These are areas that we wanted to flesh out the narrative a little bit so that it was easy for folks to come and see with one kind of a click what were all the resources pertaining to that. You know, maybe some other future work would be I would work more in tandem with someone from the Navajo Nation in order to maybe establish better categories and ways of learning and understanding. Knowledge is distributed in so many different ways in Indigenous contexts that it's not fair to just prescribe them into one that I might feel is appropriate. But for the sake of getting information out the door to at least tell communities what we have that pertains to various subjects, I thought that that was at least a good place to start, and I would certainly have been open to improvements on how that process could be facilitated.
No, that's great you point that out, because I think that happens with many of these projects is we approach it in a certain way, but that we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves, or that we should know that that we can, you know, have hindsight to say, okay, maybe I could have done this differently, but then also see the amount of work that you were able to produce and contribute that will go back to the community. But then being able to have those lessons learned then helps somebody then maybe in the future who might be either carrying that on or want to do that same type of project in their repository, that they know, okay, NAU approached it this way, we can also do it like that. But you might also begin to have those conversations ahead of time and work with somebody from their community if they're available. But I think just even providing those small examples of how you approached your work and identifying those materials, that's huge for many of the communities that might not even know what you have, because then from there, you talked about some of those digital projects and issues that you were able to address before any of that material was then either digitized or shared or anything like that. So just being able to identify, I think, is that huge first step.
Right.
Yeah. So in doing both that project, and then I know you mentioned quite a few others, whether it's digital projects or deciding if collections are going to be deaccessioned because of it's not a good fit for the repository any longer, or other projects that you've identified to enhance the cataloging. How have you went about building those relationships with those communities you've worked with? And particularly if you can highlight maybe the length of time that takes and just how you personally have approached building those respectful relationships?
Well, I'll use one example, and it's an anthropological collection, which I think I talk about in the case study. I've talked about it in a couple of different areas, but we still have pieces of it, an anthropologist's collection in our at Klein Library. And it was an interesting one where we couldn't provide a lot of access to some of the records because of not just cultural sensitivity issues, but ownership issues. We learned a lot working with our anthropology community about how anthropologists can look at records that pertain to excavations or other kinds of our salvage archaeology on tribal land or other land agencies, and who actually owns that information. Just because it's in our repository doesn't mean that we necessarily own it. It just means that at one point, a deed of gift was hopefully signed that gave rights to something to Klein Library. But it's always important to not just take that as the final word, because there's often a lot of nuance behind that legal deed of gift that we really faced with this particular collection. So we worked with the anthropologist, archaeologist for the Hualapai tribe, and that's where this really began, because he and his colleagues at the Hualapai were able to help us better understand the impact that this particular anthropologist had for their community, both positively and negatively, actually more or less positively, but that there was an incredible amount of information in this collection at our institution that really wasn't the legal property of Klein Library, Northern Arizona University. So we spent a long time developing a project to really examine closely this whole collection to really understand those issues of land ownership, because that's often where the records and the rights reside, is with the land owner that the work was done on. So we worked closely with our museum colleagues in the state. We worked with a number of other tribal colleagues, actually, who were also impacted. And we became aware that this was going to be a project that actually was going to involve a significant amount of deaccessioning in order to return materials where they actually most appropriately belonged. So not just tribal, but other states and other land agencies. So we spent some time, quite a bit of time on that, but we utilized the identification of tribally owned records as a form of outreach for maybe those that we haven't talked to ever before. So we actually had a small amount of material that related to the Yavapai Prescott Apache tribe, and we invited them up to Klein Library to not only look at these materials, but also be offered them back to them directly. And it was a really wonderful experience to be in the reading room with them when they were looking at these materials, and they were just really, really awestruck with what was in there, that they actually could fill in some gaps with their own genealogy. And they were just really excited and thrilled that we, as a large institution, were in a position to do that, because maybe that hadn't been their experience before. So, you know, again, it's that power, you know, what are we willing to let go in order to establish a better dynamic with somebody? And so I always want to preface some of this information by saying that I work really hard as well to balance my traditional archival theory and practice with what I'm doing with this form of deaccessioning. I'm not repatriating these records. They're not a form of a NAGPRA thing. It's just the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. With these kinds of materials is to look at options that make the most sense to help preserve the whole of the records wherever possible. And so we can do that through the finding guide, and we can make sure that the chain of custody of where these materials went to is retained, so that if individuals are interested in learning about the Yavapai Prescott Apache portion of this anthropologist's work, they can contact that tribal entity for access to those materials. And I felt like that struck a nice balance between preserving this person's work and their career. And we hung on to an awful lot that was really fine for Klein Library to have. We're not talking about a lot of stuff that went to another institution, but it just was the right thing to do in certain cases. In some cases, deaccessioning is not the correct solution. And maybe it's a series of restrictions for a period of time. That also involves a good long back and forth with source communities to help them develop trust with what you're thinking about doing. But I just thought that a preliminary icebreaker of actually giving them some of those things was a great kind of foray into that trust building.
No, I think that's such a great example in how you've situated it and clarified that this isn't repatriation, it's deaccessioning, and it's trying to balance that, and also highlighting the fact that it's just simply the right thing to do. And I think that also highlights that the protocols are certainly these guidelines that we have created, but that should just be the basis of the work that you, at all costs, you should try to go. You can certainly go above and beyond what the protocols are advising, especially in building relationships and in doing the right thing. That's what we advocate for as well. And it's interesting that you give that example, because I'm also working on a case study to provide for this series as well. And the one that I plan to delve into is one that's very similar, where we also deaccession material or loaned material for a certain amount of time, with a similar situation where the anthropologist faculty at the university had expressed actually that this portion of material should actually go back to the community because it's so culturally sensitive. And so there are some really great examples, I think, that we can give to other folks out there to provide them with. There actually are solutions that are out there that we can provide about not only how to build those relationships, but then what does it actually practically look like to actually do a return or a deaccession to a community. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's really important to share those examples so people understand, yes, repositories are actually doing this type of work, and this is what it looks like, that it can, it doesn't have to be, yes, it's a lot of work, but it doesn't also have to be too messy or complicated. It can be just creating that partnership with these tribal communities, like you said, because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I would just also want to say that I'm not an expert in understanding what all the nuances are about what might be sensitive for various communities. And I really rely on them to help me understand so I can develop my own kind of awareness and humility about what it is that I can be doing into the future if I see similar things. But yeah, I think there's other institutions that have been doing great work in this area to really develop the intentional spaces to bring people in, or give materials to communities to look at directly, kind of breaking down some of our traditional access paradigms a little, so that we can be a little bit more flexible with when we see the benefit to good collaboration. That kind of outweighs some of our concerns about, you know, what it means to actually have things leave the building or have multiple people looking at something. It's a balance.
Yeah, no, but I think that's really good you point that out, because it is important to keep that in mind when you're building these relationships and adhering to not only everything that you have to do in your position, but balancing that with the tribal community partners that you're building these relationships with, and remembering that they are the ones with that knowledge of their materials, of also of those people who studied their communities, and just pointing that out and having that in mind, I think is really important. Because I think that, I mean, of course, we're talking about Native American collections, but I think that pertains to numerous different collections. You would always want to go to the experts, to the people who actually created the records, to the ones that were involved with the creation of the records. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that will know how to care for those records, the appropriate terminology for cataloging. And that's what we're really hoping people try to understand out of this information that we share with them, that we hope that they continue to go to these community partners. One of the other great things that you point out in this case study is just how to do appropriate consultations and work with communities. So I guess I'm wondering if there may be one or two things that you could share with people, particularly from your time at NAU and being involved with these different projects and in doing building relationships and doing consultations on that kind of larger practical level, what are some what's some guidance that you would give to other people who are really wanting to do this type of work but maybe don't know where to start or what even consultation looks like when you build these relationships?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm always reminded that there are words have meaning, and I remember, and maybe you remember, at the 2012 gathering that we had at the Museum of Northern Arizona, Jamie Lavallee would talk about collaboration and consultation as two very different words. Mm-hmm. Consultation can often have a derogatory a meaning that you're basically giving somebody this option or that option, whereas collaboration is a true kind of trying to understand the other person's perspective to come up with the best solution for the one involved that, the one that have the biggest impact. Mm-hmm. So those words really stuck with me after I heard that. So I'm always careful to use consultation and collaboration kind of separately, one from the other. In the case study, I'm trying to remember who I talked about or what situation, but I just want to say that a lot of this work is really guided by the motivation of the individual who's really wanting to spearhead this kind of an activity. They may have good intentions. They may just need to learn a couple of things. They may make some mistakes along the way. But I think the most important thing is that there's a human capacity and connection and a desire to want to change something. It can't be something that you're assigned. I think it needs to be something that comes from within. It's in your job description, sure, but I think it also needs to come from a level of desire to engage in an action that will right a historic wrong, or that will rebalance some inequity, or provide opportunities to feed into a professional's desire for social justice or advocacy work. So I think that that's kind of a built-in piece of it. I'd say that, of course, when you're working with communities, exercise a lot of patience and, be humble and thankful and, give things time. It'll happen if it happens, and don't try to force anything. But again, I would examine, if you're at an institution and you're wondering where to start, start by looking more inward and look for those areas in which there are inequities, where there's a balance that's just off kilter, and see if that may be the reason why some collaboration really hasn't happened in the first place. I know for large institutions and academic universities, for example, it's really difficult because there's entirely humongous boundaries and structures that kind of dictate those kinds of levels of engagement. But look for those areas, and that's where I would say you're going to find where some of the greatest opportunity is to enact the greatest amount of change, is at the systemic and institutional level. But I think that a situation where I was able to do some actual consultation work for the White Mountain Apache, back in 2015, I was pulled and asked to visit with them down in Arizona, southern central Arizona. And I'd never been there before. And it was a really, really humbling opportunity for me to hear directly from those who had been managing and maintaining the historic records, the museum objects, the library materials, what some of the struggles were, not just with the management of those materials, but from the community themselves. And what they really wanted to know was that there was a person that was there that was gonna help them, that heard them, that they felt heard. And mm-hmm. I think that was probably one of my biggest takeaways and humbling moments, was to be a part of something in which I definitely was not in my wheel. I was from outside. I was coming in, and I needed to make sure that I wasn't going to be that person that thought they had all the answers right out the gate. I needed to stop and listen. So that was probably what I did for at least a day.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that, because I think more often than not, many of the people who may be watching these webinars and wanting to get guidance on doing this work are usually non-Native archivists or curators or information professionals who are wanting to get guidance about how to do this work and hopefully are coming from a good place and wanting to do this work and engage in this work, and or maybe they are trying to also get their larger repository or institution on board, and so being able to see some of how NAU has approached this, whether it's through the memorandums of agreements or through those strategic objectives that the university has set, or even just the examples you've shared. I think that's really great to point out that it does take somebody who has and wants to do this type of work through human connection, that it like you said, it can be something that sure is in your job description, but you also have to have a desire to want to do this work. And that being able to have that, because that's not something that you can prescribe or I think, try to fake in trying to reach out to communities. It has to be something that comes from within. And I really also liked your comment about this is especially helpful when we're trying to give guidance about how to build respectful relationships, how to begin these projects. It's really about listening. It's around sitting down with people from these tribal communities just to listen to them so that they can finally be heard about so many different, whether it's collections or maybe previously if there were maybe not so great consultations or collaborations that happened. So it is just sitting down and listening and hearing what are the challenges they're facing and how can we as repositories help them with whatever issues that they might be dealing with, but then how we're hoping some of the projects we want to do could also help in that area. So I think just pointing those things out is super helpful to people because it gives them some guidance on how to move forward with this, and that it doesn't have to be too complex, but you do have to come at it from a good way, mm-hmm. and that you're coming at it from with good intentions, I think is really important. Mm-hmm. Since there is this larger theme that we're trying to cover today about building respectful relationships and just how you go about doing that, which so much of what you've shared with us already really touches on that. I think maybe just one of my last questions would be, as you have worked over the years at NAU, and then as you transition into your work now in your new position, maybe what's a couple of the biggest lessons learned that you have as you move forward? And I know you've already kind of touched on a few of them, but if you have any other good lessons learned for people as they embark on doing these types of projects or even just taking maybe their first steps in, of working with tribal communities, what would be your guidance or biggest lessons learned for them?
Well, coming from Arizona to New Mexico, let's just start with coming from Canada to the United States back in 2008. You know, I'm a Canadian and now an American as of last year. And I feel like I have learned an incredible amount in that time period about what it means to not generalize and put people into boxes, but understand that each community or each group of people really has their own way of doing something or thinking about something. And it's tough to generalize. And so really, it is about applying a kind of a different set of concepts and principles to each group that you work with. And, you know, here I was coming from Arizona to New Mexico, and it's like, oh, okay, well, it's the Southwest, and so similar issues, similar kind of politics, and, you know, immediately I'm told, oh, it's really different in New Mexico. It's not the same. So each pueblo has its own entirely different way of thinking about something. So now I have 19 different collaborations I get to look at. Hopefully I find materials in our collections here at the Health Sciences Library that support some of those communities and that I can use those as leveraging points to engage and have some good conversations with folks about them, about respectful use and management of them. I also think it's really your institution you're coming from and the support that you get from them is gonna really dictate a lot of your own kind of ability to explore and try some things and to look around. Klein Library gave me a lot of that support because they already knew it was built into the core of the institution. here at the University of New Mexico, at the Health Sciences Library in particular, I have to say that they hadn't heard of the protocols before. And so now one of my jobs in a new environment is to talk about that, to get information out to my colleagues, to get support that flies up the flagpole and maybe comes back down, so that when I start talking about things, that it isn't some kind of crazy out there idea, but it's actually supported by a lot of different entities and organizations, such as a sister institution just 4 hours away in Flagstaff. So actually this Thursday, I'll be presenting for the staff and the faculty about my recent time at the Association of Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums meeting last month in Temecula. And I'll talk about our session that we did, but also applying some of the ideas that I've been working with over the last 11 years in Arizona, and how I can see intersection already with what they're doing here at UNM at the Health Sciences Library. I found policies that talk about things that are very similar sounding to the protocols. So already they're open to these kinds of ideas. And just the other day, the chancellor of the Health Sciences Center informed us that the strategic plan will now include a section on diversity and inclusion, which actually gives us yet another kind of a chipping away at something to help normalize. So I think I'm answering your question from a couple of different areas, but I think the things that I've learned are one size fits all doesn't necessarily apply for communities, and that work for advocacy with institutions will always be ongoing. You know, so if you're at a place that doesn't seem like it's receptive to these thoughts and ideas, keep fighting, keep going. It's all right.
Yeah. No, I think those are great lessons learned, and also will be constant themes throughout these conversations that we have throughout the webinars, because that's, of course, another larger theme of the protocols is each community is unique and different. And what works for one community, or what worked maybe for you at NEU with the Hopi or Zuni or the other communities you worked with, it's going to be completely different with the new 19 pueblos that you're working with in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So I think that's great to point out. And also just, you know, this is real world experience that is happening to you in real time, as well as it's so wonderful to hear that you're going to be able to take that all of that great experience that you gained at NAU and apply it to this new environment and library at the University of New Mexico, and, you know, bringing this new perspective. And it's wonderful to hear already the great reception that that has had. And I think the one thing that I'll just point out, and kind of it speaks to this larger theme that we've talked about here today, is that it does take human people to do this work, to have this drive to make a change and be really passionate about it. So I think that's important that people know that while we have maybe isolated projects that we work on to do this, that this is a long-term kind of career commitment to do this work. And we know that it takes a lot of work, but we are committed to doing this type of really substantial life-changing work because we know how important it is. So I just want to say thank you for doing this incredible work and continuing to do it as you move to this new position. And I'm excited to see what you're going to accomplish at University of New Mexico and all the great things that you're going to do. I know you're going to make lots of amazing changes there in a good way. So just thank you so much for all your work.
Oh, Jennifer, thank you. It's been a pleasure being a part of this, and always nice to see you and work with you.
Yeah. Just thank you so much for sharing more in depth about the case study and your work. This was the whole kind of purpose and idea behind doing this, is it gives an opportunity for people who have written about this work to then kind of just share some more and have a conversation about it, and for people to be able to listen to that and hear that. And then once we do launch this video up on the Sustainable Heritage Network, this will give people a chance to be able to watch this video. And then in a couple weeks time from now, then we'll do some Q&A session. We'll do some live Q&A, as well as we'll have people send in questions. So you might get questions from people, or I will try to coordinate some of those questions as people have them. So you might get some follow-up from people, but I'll help to coordinate that. So remind people where you're at, what position you're in, and then as part of this, we'll also most likely post your email if that's okay with
yes.
you.
Yep.
So just remind us where you're at and how people can find you.
Sure. I'm at the University of New Mexico's Health Sciences Center at the Health Sciences Library and Informatics Center. Big long word. Basically, it's the medical library at the North Campus of UNM. Mm-hmm. And I am the special collections, the scholarly communications and digital librarian, which means that I'm helping manage and maintain the institution's archival holdings, as well as various pieces of the scholarly communication program. And then I'm also helping sustain and manage and maintain over the long term the Native Health Database, which is a really invaluable resource that's indexed over 10,000 individual articles, newspaper clippings, journal pieces, other great literature that has been used by thousands of people every year. So they're looking to move this into a new direction. So I get to help manage and maintain where that moves into the future. So that's where I am. And to reach me, you can Google the Health Sciences Library Informatics Center, and then there's a staff directory and I'm there. But I'm sure that my contact information can be shared as well through this video in some capacity.
Yes, we will share your contact information at the end. So all of your fans will send you all of your all the email. But nice. We just thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me today and to be able to share all the experiences and lessons learned that you have. We anticipate that you'll get some questions, so we'll forward those to you and we'll get those to you. And so I'm sure you might get some questions from people, but again, just thank you so much for sharing your perspective, your lessons learned, and your experiences that you've had. We hope that this has also been fun for you to talk a little bit more about your experiences. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks. It's been a little nostalgic. It's good.
Yeah. We've, of course, worked together for a long time on disseminating information about the protocols. So this is just another wonderful way to be able to do that. So we, of course, wish you all the best in your next steps with your job. And they're going to keep you very busy, it sounds like.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
The Society of American Archivists Native American Archives section also has an information and resources page that provides highlights to a variety of different publications, blogs, and presentations, all highlighting the history and other case studies regarding the protocols. Again, this first episode highlights building relationships of mutual respect. Hosted by Jennifer O'Neill and includes an in-depth conversation with Jonathan Pringle based on his recent protocols case study covering his work at Northern Arizona University's Klein Library, and covers the following topics: strategies and steps for implementing the protocols to build relationships of mutual respect, the importance of establishing memorandum of agreements and other policies with tribal communities, as well as major lessons learned when first building relationships and partnerships with Native American tribes. Listed here is a link to his case study titled Northern Arizona University's Klein Library and the Protocols. After you've had a chance to view this webinar, on December 6, 2019, we'll be having a live Q&A on Facebook and Twitter. So please stay tuned for further details about the Q&A and when that will take place. Another outcome from these webinars is we'll be producing a Protocols Implementation Toolkit. That will be forthcoming in spring 2020, that we will develop over the course of the webinar series and bring together all of the different core tenets of the different sections that we are covering. It is our hope that by watching the webinars and implementing the toolkit, you'll have the core basics that you need to actually begin to implement the protocols at your repository or institution. Thank you so much for taking the time to watch these webinars and engage in our live Q&As, and we look forward to hearing from you.